My name is Terry Cruz, and I'm an alcoholic. Hello, Atlanta! Woohoo! I am so excited to be here. I want to thank you for having me. So these workshops, sometimes we get them, sometimes we don't get them, sometimes we get to choose the topic, and sometimes, like me, I keep my big mouth shut and I get assigned something. And I don't know about Rich, but my thought process is there are 12 steps, and if I got to choose, I think 6 and 7 would be at the very bottom. Because they're such limited in the big book. It's like the bottom of page 75 and the top of 76, right? But I did bring my big book, so I've got some notes here. I did not steal this from Julie. Is Julie in the room? She's not here. Yeah, so this does look like hers, but it's actually mine. So anyway, I want to throw a disclaimer out there. So I am not an authority on the steps. I'm just a girl from Woodville, Ohio, that found a solution to her drinking problem. And I had a spiritual awakening as a result of working the 12 steps to the best of my ability. And I have fumbled footballs along the way. I have fallen down. I've scraped my knees. But what I haven't done was pick up a drink. And I have successfully managed to string together 25 years of sobriety. And I'm not saying that to impress you. It impresses the heck out of me. And so I'm not an authority on this, but I have worked the steps. And so the only thing that I have to bring to the table this afternoon is my experience with step 6 and 7 and what that looked like for me and the way it was presented to me through my sponsor and the way that I've interpreted the literature and what we have to work with. So that's what I'm going to bring to the table. I've had some anxiety about it. I talked to my friend Doug yesterday. I've talked to my friend John. And so yesterday Doug was like, well, why all this anxiety? You do these workshops all the time. Why do you have anxiety? I'm like, I don't know. I guess I just want to do a good job. And he said, oh, you want to impress a bunch of alcoholics? Gosh, Doug, well, since you put it like that, no. That wasn't what I was thinking. But he said, that's my pride and that's my ego. So the anxiety I felt was based on pride and based on ego. So what I'm going to do is just pocket my pride, right? That's what the big book says. We pocket our pride and we just get to it. So I'm just going to get into it. So on page 75, at the bottom of 75, we have very distinct instructions coming from our co-founder on what we're supposed to do on step 6. So the opening paragraph says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. It says, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. That's a prayer. That's a prayer of gratitude. I come home and I am quiet for an hour and I say a prayer of gratitude. I thank God that I know him better because something is starting to happen. After I've just, when I embark on step 6, I've just left my sponsor. Because if I was to back up, if we were going to talk about steps 4 and 5, step 6 commences at the conclusion of step 5, same day, same evening, same time. So it says, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better, and we take this book down from the shelf where we turn to the page which contains the first 12, or the 12 steps, which is page 55. So it's telling me when I come home, I say a prayer of gratitude, I go get my big book, I open it to page 59, and I read the first 5 proposals, right? And it's interesting to note, and somebody pointed this out to me yesterday, it's interesting to note that step 6 is the only step where we pause. We're instructed to pause. There's a pause at step 6. There's a pause for reflection. Because at this point, I need to ask myself lots of questions. And, okay, the book puts it this way, and then I'll go how Terry put it. Taking the book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps, carefully reading the first 5 proposals. We ask if we have omitted anything. Are we building an ark through which we shall walk a free man at last? Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? I interpret that to mean, to me, this is what this means. Do I still have any secrets? Is there something left unsaid that I should have said when I did my 5th step? Am I still running the show? Do I still feel like I'm in charge? Is my ego still grand? What is the loudest voice inside my head? Right? Because for a long time, it was that neurotic woman. That was the loudest voice inside my head. And I just finished my 5th step. So the loudest voice inside my head should not be that neurotic woman. right? I should feel a more nearness to my Creator. So during this period of pause, I'm asking myself all of these questions. I'm reviewing the first five proposals. And then I turn to page 59 and I review that. So going over to the 12 and 12, it's very interesting what the 12 and 12 has to say about step six. I'm trying really hard to stay on focus here about these steps. So step six in the 12 and 12 starts out by saying this is the step that separates the men from the boys. Like, and I've heard that before, and I just read it again yesterday for the first time in a while, and I thought, that sounds like a big deal to me. I don't know about you, but that sounds like a pretty big deal to me. Like this, okay, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. What exactly does he mean? And if I read down a little bit further, he lays it out for me, and he says that, it's the step that separates the men from the boys. The men that are still running on self-will, and then the men that are running on God's will. I'm in step seven. That's why I can't find it. Duh. It says, I get a step ahead of myself. It says, so the difference between the boys and the men is the difference between striving for a self-determined objective and for the perfect objective, which is God. Wow. I had to read that like three times. So the difference between the men and the boys is the difference between striving for self-determined objective and for the perfect objective, which is of God. So that means I'm not running the show, right? That self will run riot. That woman, that neurotic woman, she's not running the show anymore. So I've decided to step aside and let God have control of my life. And some of that stuff, that begins to commence actually in the third step. And that's why these steps build on top of each other. And if I'm struggling with step six and I'm having a hard time getting past step six or moving through it, I need to go back. I need to go back to step five. Or maybe it's four. Maybe I'm hung up on three. So it's always the step before. It's not the actual step of. So things start to improve. I start to get closer to my Creator. And God implies that the step six can be, or the book implies that God can apply step six to any area of my life. So I am not the person. I don't get credit for removing my characters of defect. That's not me. I don't get any more credit than if I were to remove my obsession for alcohol, because I cannot do that. That is something that is beyond my power. So these defects of character, you know, the sloth, the egotism, the big shotism, the I'm just a little bit better than you, all that stuff and that baggage that I carry, those defects of character, I can suit up and show up and I can do the steps and I can keep working a little bit closer to a closer relationship to my God. But I can't remove my defects of character. That's where God comes in. And so when I keep chugging along, it just gets a little bit better and a little bit better. And it's progress, not perfection. So turning then, let's see, to, I want to look at step, because I'm like halfway through my little time that I had set aside. So looking at step seven then, I thought for a long time, and when I say a long time, I mean like a decade. If you're here tomorrow, I mean, I've been sober a lot of years. If you come tomorrow, and I don't want to share my whole story, but I spent a lot of years in prison. And I'm going to talk a lot about that tomorrow morning. And during my incarceration, about 5 years of it was spent listening to Joe and Charlie every single day. I didn't have the resources that we have. I didn't have the literature. I didn't have the sponsor. I didn't have that ready person. I couldn't just go to the payphone and pick up and call a member of AA and have a conversation about what's going on with me today. Like, my life didn't work like that. But I had this box of these Joe and Charlie cassette tapes of a weekend that was recorded out in San Francisco in 1988, and I would listen to Joe and Charlie every single day from 4 to 4:45 when they had this thing called count time, when everybody had to be on their bunk. And while I was listening to those tapes, it was during my incarceration, with the assistance of Joe and Charlie, that I was able to learn about the first 164 pages and learn the application of the steps. And so when I went through the steps the very first time, it was under the direction and the guidance that I was getting from Joe and Charlie off of those cassette tapes right? So when I did my steps 4 and 5, I didn't have a sponsor. I wrote it all down. I did it to the best of my ability under the direction and guidance that I was getting off those cassette tapes. And then I set up an appointment. There was this old man. His name was Father Tom. And he was a Catholic priest that used to come in every Saturday, and he would do this Catholic mass for the and I wasn't even Catholic. Like, I had no religion, okay? I grew up without, well, some really messed up notions about who God was. And I'll talk more about that tomorrow because I'm your spiritual speaker. I don't know. And so... Anyway, I went over to meet with Father Tom on a Saturday afternoon. He came early one time, or maybe he stayed late. I don't remember. And I did my fifth step. And he gave me, he was a Catholic priest, so he gave me a rosary and made me go back to my cell and do 10 Hail Marys. I don't know. And I'm like, I think I'm supposed to be quiet for an hour. That's what Joe and Charlie said. He said, you'll do that, but first I want you to do these 10 Hail Marys, and then you're going to be quiet for an hour. And you know what? I look back on that, and I did that to the best of my ability. I did it with what I had to work with. But it brought to the table a sense of humility, right? A little bit of Terry getting out of herself, because all my life it's always been all about me, me, me. More, bigger, longer, stronger, harder. If you went to Washington, Seattle, I'd been to Anchorage. You know, I just had just a little bit further, a little bit more, you know, than what you had done. And I lived my way my whole life. And if I was to get honest, and this is an honest program, the truth of the matter is I have this inferiority complex. I feel inferior. I feel like I don't measure up. There's something about me that's, I'm just not quite good enough. And so I have to embellish these things and act superior to cover up for this inferior complex. Does that make any sense? I know it sounds stupid, but it makes perfect sense to me because I lived that way for so many years. And so I'm in the penitentiary, and I'm doing the steps to the best of my ability. And I went back to my cell, and I did the 10 Hail Marys, and I wouldn't even know how to do a Hail Mary today. I mean, he gave me this piece of paper and showed me the beads and had me go through. And I did that. I did what he asked me to do. And then I tried to be quiet for an hour. It's not very quiet in the penitentiary. But I did it to the best of my ability. And I reviewed the steps that are on page 59. And what's interesting about step 7, if I go back into the big book, you know why I like the big book as such a reference? Because Dr. Bob signed off on this. And I don't mean to be disparaging to the 12 and 12. I love the 12 and 12. I think it's a great resource. But I always go to the big book first. The big book is our text. It's our textbook. And so returning back to the big book, because that's always my first reference is always the big book. On page 76, at the top of 76, here we go. He says, if we can answer to our satisfaction, then we look at step 6. Wait, what? I just did all that stuff. I was quiet for an hour. I did all that review. And now he's telling me, after I've done all that, now I can look at step 6. Because there's that pause. There's that preparation. We prepare to do step 6. And so then it says, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Willingness. And are we now ready to have God remove all these things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can we now take them all? Can he take them all, every one? And then he goes on to say, if we still cling to something that we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. This is the second time in 2 paragraphs that he's suggesting that we say a prayer again. So I'll read that again. He says, if we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. So I say a prayer of willingness, not the 7-step prayer. I haven't got there yet. My first prayer is a prayer of gratitude because I know God better. And my second prayer is a prayer of willingness. That's what my big book says it right there. And that's what I had to do. So I said a prayer for willingness. God, help me be willing because I just want to do this thing right. And I want to do it to the best of my ability. So then moving on to step 7, this is what it says on page 76. When ready, you know, this might be an hour, might be 2 hours, might be 3. But when we're ready, we say something like this. And the 7th step prayer is on page 76. And I'm just going to share it with you here. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. I just got home from the sponsors an hour ago, and I have done the preparation. I've said a prayer of gratitude, a prayer of willingness, and then I said my 7-step prayer, and I've completed step 7. It's the same evening. I'm still at home. Now, back in the day, like, they didn't drag out the steps like we do. Like, they, and actually, I think in the early days, they only had 6 steps. But the point being, on page 76, we're moving. We're moving. We're not farting around. Like, we're doing steps 5, step 6, step 7, and then step 8. It launches right into it. And I just want to quickly put a couple blurbs out there for step. I know we're not doing step 8, but it says, now we need more action, without which we find faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of persons we have harmed to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. I'm still at home. I have this piece of paper because I just left the sponsors, and I have step 8 on this piece of paper. See? So at the end of the day, I've actually ended up on step 9. If I've done the steps properly, if I've done it the way it's outlined in the book, at the end of the day, I've arrived at step 9. So it says, just a couple of footnotes here. Page 76, third paragraph. I don't know what that means. More prayer required. I have so many notes out. You ought to see this thing. I mean, I was impressed with Julie's book, but some of the stuff, I don't even know what I was thinking when I wrote it, but okay. Anyway, so step 6 and 7 actually are preparation. If I do step 6 and 7 right, what they do, if I've done them completely and if I've been thorough and if I've meant business and I did it to the best of my ability, what that does is it sets me up to gain access to that spiritual experience that's talked about in the back of the big book on that chapter, spiritual experience. It puts me in a position to have my defects of character removed, to get closer to my Creator. It gives me access to a spiritual experience, as described in the 12th step, right? All these things put me in position, and so we just keep chugging along. I just do it to the best of my ability. I've used up my allotted time. Rich, you want me to keep going? Well, he's like, roll, baby. Okay, so I do want to talk a little bit about, I'm just going to turn my attention here then. The spiritual experience on page 569, is anybody familiar with that little, it's like 2 pages in the back, and I really think this is applicable here. I think this has a lot to do with this, because I'm growing my relationship with my Creator, this person that I could never get close to, because I always thought God was up there, out there somewhere, and voila, He's right here, and He's been there the whole time cheering me on, like not keeping score and saving a real hot, fiery place for me. Like, that's not His function. And I was just really messed up in the area of God and what God's role was in my life and what God's supposed to do. And so step 6 and 7 actually put me in a position where I can grow that relationship, right? Because now, by now I've gained a little bit of humility, right? Because it's not always all about me, and I'm able to listen. I can listen and I can look you in the eyes. When you're talking to me, I can look in your eyes. Because I'm not hiding anything. I don't have any more secrets. Those secrets, you ever hear that phrase, you're only as thick as your secrets? Those are reservations. That's the stuff that's going to send me back out. So I need to get rid of that stuff. So I don't want to keep any secrets. I don't want to hang on to that stuff. So in the spiritual experience, and it's interesting, do we know why that He found it necessary after the first printing to insert this page at the back of the book, right? There was a lot of confusion between spiritual experience, spiritual awakening. You know, everybody thought, based on reading Bill Wilson's story, that we had to have this burning bush experience with this bright light. Whoa, there's God. And so people were scared, like, oh, God, like, I have not had that. Like, I have to have that in order to recover. And so what Bill Wilson wanted to do was expand on that a little bit and say, you know what, I had a spiritual experience, but the variety that most people have is actually a spiritual awakening. And what is a spiritual awakening? It happens slowly over a period of time, kind of like waking up. I don't just wake up and then 2 minutes later I'm in my office at my desk working. I open my eyes, I kind of look around the room, then the first thought is, what day is this? Oh yeah, it's Monday. Okay, it's Monday. I look at the alarm clock. What time is it? I calculate in my head, what time do I have to be in the shower? Do I need to wash my hair today? Yeah, no, I washed it yesterday. And so there's this slow process of waking up, you know, and then you put on the pot of coffee, you get the daily meditation. So it happens over a period of time. So Bill Wilson is saying that this is how our relationship with our Creator develops. It develops slowly over a period of time. And that was what happened to me. And I think part of my problem, and I know I've talked to so many alcoholics that were in the same boat as me, is that the twisted views that I had, that my childhood God and the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous are two very different gods. And thank God that Alcoholics Anonymous, that Abby Thatcher actually at the table said to Bill, suggested, why don't you get a God of your own understanding? That was a game changer for me, because if that hadn't happened, if that hadn't transpired and we didn't have that in our literature, I wouldn't be standing here, because I could not develop a relationship with a God of my understanding from my childhood. That I'm running from him. I'm not running to him. I'm running from him. And so Alcoholics Anonymous gave me permission to wipe the slate clean and get a God of my understanding and to kind of start over with that. And so I was able to do that. And then this profound alteration then, so this thing starts to unfold. This gift starts to happen. The way that we think starts to change. What? How does that happen? Because I'm not in charge of that. I can pick and choose my thoughts. I guess when a thought comes into my brain, you know, I know I'm 25 years sober, but every now and then this really funky, weird, kind of like, what was that? But I don't sit there and entertain it. I don't toy with it. But the big book tells me that we will have a profound alteration in our reaction to life. A profound alteration. I don't have the power to do that, but God does. And that's where the recovery comes in, because we are born anew. We become new people. We grow a new skin. And other people notice it before we do, right? And there's a couple of different places in the big book where Bill Wilson's talking about that sparkle in his eye, right? When we start to get well on the inside, and then I get to where I can look in the mirror and I start thinking, you know, maybe I'm not such a schmuck after all. You know, after everything I did and the way I lived my life, you know, and I had to go to the penitentiary to put the plug in the jug because I was such a sick alcoholic that I could not set it down. God doing for me what I could not do for myself. And on a sentence of 4 to 10, I had to do the whole 10. What? Yeah. Come back tomorrow morning and you'll get the full story. So anyway, that's kind of my take on step 6 and 7. I want to thank you for letting me share. I hope I tried to stay on track. So with that, I'm going to turn the podium over to my friend Rich.
That was awesome. My name is Rich. I'm an alcoholic. Saturday afternoon, 4 o'clock, a lot of sitting. There's an AA rumor that one of my sponsors, Bob, was at one of those Woodstock events. I don't know if anybody's been to them. It's for the really, really sick AAs, that like a speaker for each step, and it's like the Bataan Death March of AA. Like, you will sit for 14 consecutive hours. You will hear a speaker on each and every step. You will continue to sit and go through another, right? And, you know, at some time on Sunday, we might let you get up, right? And Bob is not a big fan of that format for that reason. He just thinks it's rather self-indulgent and rude to make people sit that long. And he was assigned step 6 or 7 at a Woodstock. And it was about this time on a Saturday. And you all had been sitting for a long time. And he gave what is, in some circles, thought of to be the most profound and succinct talk on step 6 and 7 ever given. He said, thank you all for sitting. I am on step 6 and 7. Stop being an a-hole. Enjoy your break. And that was the end of the talk, right? And some would say that that sums up step 6 and 7, right? In its totality, some of what I've learned about 6 and 7, and I love people that have the ability to, you know, break it down like that. In case you haven't figured it out, I'm just kind of like a storyteller. And in there, you might learn, hear, experience something about God and the step. That's one of the reasons AA works, by the way. There's a book called Not God, which is kind of all you need to know about AA, by a guy named Ernest Kurtz. And in there, he talks about one of the reasons that AA works is that what we do, as you heard, we're not teachers, we're not we're not anything. We just share our story. See, if it's one of the things that's very different. If you go to a lot of different places on Sunday mornings, there's people trying to talk at God. They're trying to put words on the experience. They're trying to tell you, you know, how to pray, what to pray, when to pray, say it like this, stand up, sit down, over here, you know, and all of this stuff, right? We don't do any of that in AA. We just tell our stories. And in those stories, you see and experience God. Right? And that's why AA works, because that's what we do. And we don't have to put a whole lot on it. We just tell the story. And in those stories, I've heard you guys say that, you know what, in step 6 and 7, if there were more we could do, there would be more written. Right? We just heard pointed out beautifully. It's 2 paragraphs. Right? If there were more we could do, there would be more written. There'd be more directions. I mean, step 9, there's like 14 pages of directions. Right? Where they want us to have a lot of directions, there's a lot of directions. I do love the 12 and 12. I don't hope I don't upset anybody, you know. Like I like all of it. On step 6 and 7, I think it's some of the best information that Bill gives us. It's some of the most beautiful writing I've ever read. I mean, it's like poetry, step 6 and 7. And we got a story in the back of the big book called The Keys to the Kingdom by Sylvia Cole. Anybody ever seen that story back there, The Keys to the Kingdom? Some people like to think of it as the kingdom. We heard Earl this morning talk about entering a place of perfect peace and ease. Some people might call that heaven. Some people might use other words, right? Whatever that means, right, that you've been given the keys to the kingdom, right? And turns out, in my experience, there's only one rule to entering the kingdom, right? Welcome. I mean, the door is open. It's right over there. It's open all the time. Everybody has equal access to it. Anyone interested, right, in entering the kingdom? Right? But there's only one rule. You can't bring any of your kingdom in. That's why it's a place of perfect peace and harmony. Right? Because what is my kingdom? Right? What is my kingdom? My kingdom is my thoughts, my beliefs, my opinions. Right? The me, anything that starts who and what I am. Right? And Bill talks about that. You know, if I gave all of that up, I mean, what would become of me? Right? I'd be the hole in the donut. There'd be nothing left of me. And they go over there, they go, yeah. That's who's in the kingdom. Holes and donuts, right? And that's why it's so peaceful and wonderful in here. And that's the price of admission, is giving up me. And I go, whoa. Right? And these 12 steps are not 12 steps up to anything. They're 12 steps down to humility. And 6 and 7, more than anything else, what they're asking me to do is to kill off, to literally kill. And in step 6 and 7, it talks about pain, right? That pain is going to be the touchstone of this growth. That's where we're first introduced to that concept, right? And I can experience pain one of two ways in AA. I could experience the pain of not changing, or I could experience the pain of changing. But there's going to be pain, right? And literally what's happening is I'm getting rid of me. And what does that look like? What are these defects? What are the, you know, shortcomings? We could get into hour-long talks. I've been to meetings, right? What do you think he meant? You know, and I'm like, I don't know. Who cares? Like, whatever it means to you, word technician, right? And I heard somebody share one time that our defects are the things that we're doing that we shouldn't be, and our shortcomings are the things we should be doing that we're not. And I'm like, all right, I kind of took that's cool. I can work with that. And, you know, by the way, anything I say, if your sponsor tells you anything different, listen to your sponsor. I mean, I'm like an idiot, right? Like, just they know, not me. These are just some things I've experienced along the way. And he gives us this list, right? So what I believe, my experience, what my defects are, is anything that separates me from you. Right? Because we talked about last night, if I'm separate from you, I'm separate from God. And what I'm trying to do here is get closer to God. Because the best thing that I've ever read is by Chuck Chamberlain in A New Pair of Glasses. And if you're new and you've never read that, read it. Because in there he says that there is only one problem, right? Conscious separation from God. And there is only one solution, right? Conscious companionship or conscious connection to God. So my defects or shortcomings are anything that separates me from God. And the bad news for me is that the closest I'm ever going to get to God is you. That's how I interact with God. This is the best it's going to get for me and God. Because inside of every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And when I'm talking to you, I'm talking to God. Because without you, there is no God. And without God, there is no you. And this is as close as it's going to get. And I better learn. A book talks about that I have a fundamental inability to form a meaningful relationship with my Creator. Right? And there's all these things. Envy. Sloth. Gluttony. You know, this bill. I'm not saying you got to agree with them. It's what's in the book, right? And he goes through, and he calls these some of our chief defects. And then he hits me with the big one for a guy like me. Pride. Pride heads the list, right? That's what it says, is pride heads the list. And pride is why I do some of the things I heard talk. There was a guy in the D.C. area named Hal Marley, and he's the guy that like had those pins that said attitude of gratitude. If anybody's guy, he used to give those out if you got one. And Hal's neighbor used to have polio, right? And he had those polio, you guys remember the old polio crutches, right? And he would drag, and he would apparently jog, Hal, 2 miles every day, 2 miles. And it was a Saturday morning, and he did his 2-mile jog, and he's coming back, finishes up on a, you know, Saturday, Sunday morning, whatever it was. And the neighbor with the polio is going out to get the newspaper. The guy can barely walk. And he goes, "Hey, Hal, you just did your run this morning?" And he goes, "Yeah, just finished 3 miles. He was 40 years sober when he did that with the neighbor. Right? You get it? He just added a mile. He ran 2 miles. He says, "Yeah, just finished 3 miles. He added a mile to impress a guy that can barely walk. Right? Like you need to impress the neighbor about how far you just jogged, right? And I don't know that you guys are getting that, but boy, did I get it, right? I was like, that's the story of my life. I got to add this just little bit, right? Because of that fundamental sense of not good enough as is, right? The need to impress. You know, pride heads the list, and it shows up under the guise of all of those other things. And when I'm killing off pride through all of these steps, and I mean, make no mistake about it, it's not the step, it's the resistance to the step that causes us all of the pain, right? Because what they're designed to do, and they work, and that's why they cause a spiritual awakening, is they kill me. And you know what's left when you kill me? God. What would that be like, right? And my ego goes, "Whoa, no, no, you can't get rid of me. You know, what would I do? What's my role around here going to be? You know, I mean, if I just serve God, I mean, what would that look like?" And that's what step 6 and 7, right, is all about. And the problem with step 6 and 7, and Bill calls it the riddle of our existence in step 6 and 7, is pretend my kingdom that I'm not willing to give up to go through the door. That's available to me right on the other side there. Perfect peace and ease. I can enter the kingdom. You know who keeps me out? Not God. Not you. Me. And my unwillingness to give up, right, all of those things that make me to walk in there and experience perfect peace and ease. And yet if we talk about it, there isn't a person here that if I say, "Would you like to experience perfect peace and ease?" Right? We all go, "Yeah." And then we have to be careful with words in AA and 6 and 7. And I started to learn about that and some of my defects of what comes out of my mouth. and how it can matter in the lives of new people, and how touchy I am, right, about stuff. And like, it took me a little bit to realize, like, when people would say, like, hey, you're sensitive, that that's not necessarily a compliment, right? So there are these words in there that would get me, right? Like, here's just an example of how words matter. Could I see a show of hands of all of the sinners? Okay. Just got about 50% of the room from up here is what I'm looking at, right? Do we have anyone here, show of hands, anybody that has any character defects? Just got about 100% on that one. Okay. You want to know what I changed? A word. Right? Apparently I got defectors, but not sinners. Like, we're willing to cop to that. You know, oh, I defect frequently, but do not call that a sin. Right? You know, no sinning, but defecting, yes. Right? And that's the brilliant nature of what Bill did here, right? Was put together a program that drunks can swallow, with language we could swallow and interact with, right, before we launch off into this spiritual exploration, into wherever else that might take us. And pretend this kingdom that I can't go through that door because I'm just not willing to let go of all of those things, right? Let's pretend my kingdom is the United States. And I've already had an experience, everyone in this room has, of giving up the biggest defect of our life, turning it over 100%, right? Because that's the deal. I got to be 100% willing to give it up. And that was my drinking, my alcoholism. And that was the equivalent of surrendering the state of Maryland. But I'm not giving up Texas, man. That's where I keep my pride, right? And I'm not giving up California. That's where I like to hide my lust. Right? And Montana is where I keep my gluttony. I call it just having a good meal, you know, and no way am I giving up Oregon. I mean, Oregon is where I keep my greed. I like to call it just, you know, a little business acumen, right? And I'm not giving up Florida. That's where I keep my, you know, dishonesty, right? But I have completely surrendered Maryland. And why won't I do that, right? Why won't I do that, to walk through that door with the rest of these defects? And Bill calls that, this is the riddle of our existence. We have all experienced firsthand that if and when I become willing to give up 100% of a defect, it is 100% removed. Right? And see, the problem in my experience and working with a lot of guys is God doesn't remove part of a defect. God removes 100% of the defect or none of it. There's no like, hey, can you take away half my lust? You know, can you take, you know, in business, you know, take this honesty thing. I want to appear honest, right? But we all know, right, that when push comes to shove in a deal, every now and then you got to get in there, right? You got to make it happen, right? In a business deal, every now and then you got to stick it to them. You know, I mean, I can't be totally honest or we'd go broke, right? I mean, all the lust? I mean, what would I do with my wife in the bed? I mean, what would that look like? All the lust. See the problem? I could go through all of them. And Bill calls that the riddle of my existence. The kingdom is right there. It's available to me. It's open. It's broad, roomy, and all-inclusive. And I'm just not willing, right, to give them up 100%, all of them. And chances are, as I stay sober and become willing to surrender these piece by piece, state by state, my kingdom, right? Probably going to die holding on to one of those states, right? But I got pretty close. I got pretty close. And I think that pleases something out there in the universe, right? The journey. Haven't met any saints in AA. Haven't met anybody that's, successfully gotten rid of 100% of all their defects. You know, and my friend used to say, you don't really want to meet that person. Anybody that's perfect, you know, we kill them. That's what we do with perfect people. We've had several, you know, in history, and that's what we do is, you know, we hang them up and kill them. So I don't know that we want to get there. our intention here was to give about 20 minutes each. This thing, ends at quarter of best intentions, right? And we wanted to make it interactive. So while I'm going to tell two more stories, and while I tell those stories, I want you to think about this. This is going to be as workshoppy as you want it to be, right? 6 and 7 is the stuff we got questions about, but you can't let anybody know you got them, right? This is the place. I mean, these are vague steps, right? And we want to just dialogue a little bit about what's on your mind. I mean, we talked about what we like, right? So I want to read something about humility, right? The definition of humility, if you look it up, it's going to say the complete absence of pride, right? That high school I went to, that private school, is called Gilman, right? The logo, everything about it was Gilman pride. That might be good in the material world, but in the spiritual world, what a setback. Now you're telling me I got to get rid of this thing, right? And my material resume, there's two ways of looking at things after 6 and 7. There's the material world resume. We all have a resume, right? And there's two ways of looking at that. That resume could say, graduated the Gilman School, top of my class, valedictorian. I graduated the University of San Diego, summa cum laude. I graduated the University of San Diego Law School, second from the top in my class. I got a judicial clerkship. I, right? That's the material resume, which is a list of things that some of us think we did, right? And then there's the spiritual resume after 6 and 7, when I can look at the darn thing honestly, right? And go, holy cow, my parents worked really hard to send me to a terrific high school. All kinds of people guided me through that. God put me in just the right place at the right time that I got to go to a great high school, which got me into a great college. God lets me remember things, so I got good test scores. He also made me kind of fast, and I can jump high, which made me a goalkeeper for the soccer team. Had very little to do with that. Isn't it cool that God sent me to college? Very different resume, right? Hey, I exploded my whole life, went to make amends, had never thought of law school, but God sent me there. I have never filled out a job application after that point, and they called me because that's where God moved me, because when I stopped trying to plan things, this is where I was moved to next, into the state's attorney's office. Huh, had very little to do with that here on the spiritual resume. Right? You see how we move? It's the same document, a resume, seen through two different eyes. And this is the little story of harmony. Okay. A great conductor was once asked, what's the most difficult instrument to play in the entire orchestra? And without hesitation, he replies, second fiddle. We all want to play first fiddle, right? To sit in the lead chair, to play the more noticeable and more acclaimed parts. But without the second fiddle, there's no harmony. The success of the entire orchestra depends every bit as much on those with the humility to play second fiddle as it does on those who play the lead parts. Does this mean that the person playing the lead does not have humility? Of course not. When we're asked to play first fiddle, either as a result of ability or just availability, it's our duty as a member of the orchestra to accept the assignment and do our very best to carry it out. Harmony depends on all members of the orchestra doing their part, great or small, to the very best of their ability. The most essential ingredient of unity is harmony. The most essential ingredient of harmony is humility. And the most essential ingredient of humility is the presence of God. And when I heard that, I asked the guy to write it down for me, right? Because I need to remember that, you know, because that's my journey. It's getting rid of as much pride in this journey to humility. And where I live, we have this boardwalk that goes along the ocean. It's 2 miles up, and you know, so if you do the whole walk, it's 4 miles, and I do that quite a bit. It's one of the ways that I try to deal with my eating, right, is exercising. And because then I get to eat as much as I want. And I'm going up and down that, and there's this drunk this day stumbling along the boardwalk. The guy is falling down drunk. And that drunk comes up and God's coming the other way on the boardwalk. And he looks at God and he says, God, I just want to be sober more than anything in the world. More than anything in the world, I just want to be sober. And God said, okay, well, what do you have in your pocket? How much money do you have? And the drunk reaches in and he's got a crumpled up 50. God says, I'll take that. That's the price of your sobriety. And the drunk gladly hands it over and boom, he's sober. Just like God did for us one day, right? One day we were drunk and just like that, removed. Sober as we'll ever be. Just like that. And the drunk starts to walk away. And he doesn't get 10 steps away before he turns back and goes, hey God, I just gave you my last $50. My car's a little bit low on gas. Could I get 5 of it back for gas? And God says, car? You didn't tell me you had a car. Give me the car keys. That's part of the price of your sobriety. And reaches in his pocket and he goes to hand over those keys and he does and he goes, well, without those keys, I'm not going to be able to, you know, go to work. And if I don't go to work, I'm not going to be able to take care of my wife and kids. Job? You didn't tell me you had a job. I'll take the job. And he turns over the job. And he goes, but I'll tell you what. Here's the deal. If you remember that that car is my car, I'll let you drive it. If you remember that the job, that's my job. I'll let you work it. If you remember that family, that those are my kids, I'll help you raise them and I'll let you help me raise them. I got to remember that. And 6 and 7 helps me get to an honest place of realizing how little I have to do with this and that I made a deal, right? That there is no longer a thing called my life, right? That was that deal I made. And that if I'm all in, I'm all in. And I think that's all I want to say. Terry's going to come up with me. We have at least 15 minutes to hear some of what might trouble you, challenge you, sticking on you. What I want you to do is if you stand up, just kind of put your hand up, ask your question. We're going to repeat it so that Mike and the people in tape world can hear the question. There's nothing more awkward, right, than hearing the answer and you don't know what the question was. You're like, bet that was a good question, but we don't know. Or we're going to just stand here and have some really awkward meditation. Yes, sir.
Patrick, and I'm not calling. So step 6 and 7, where you were willing to have our conviction move, and we humbly ask God to move them. And then the 7 steps of prayer says, we humbly ask God to remove all the defects of character that stand in the way of us serving Him and others. So I'm hoping that I'm not the only one that twisted that up. It's been 7 years of sobriety, and there's a couple defects to hang around. And I question myself, like, this defect must not be standing in my way of serving God and others. I volunteer in the GSR, I take Christians into meetings, I sponsor people. I do other good shit. But this defect of character does not fit my idea, and my road is getting narrower, and I humbly ask God over and over and over to remove those defects that are standing in the way of me serving Him and others. It's still here. Do you have any experience with that?
Lots, baby, lots. And so do the rest of us. The question essentially was, I'm going to shorten it up a little bit, is does anyone have a hard time distinguishing which defects God wants removed and not removed? And I sometimes can't even tell an asset from a defect, and I'm praying, remove it. And how do I know if this is something, you know, that God wants me to have to use for good and useful purpose versus remove? And does anyone share in the struggle? Right? You want to address it?
I think so. Is that a cop-out? Actually, here's my thoughts on that. One thing that I heard him say that jumped off at me, he was like, I do a lot of service work and it doesn't seem to be getting in my way. I heard that. And the sponsor inside me, I had my little sponsor hat perked up and thought to myself, service doesn't equal sobriety, first of all. I mean, it's very helpful. Everything's very helpful. But I think it's obviously bothering you. There's something about that. You know, whatever that is, it's none of my business what it is. It's not our business. Whatever it is, it's big enough that you decided on this day, this afternoon, in front of all these people to set part of it on the table, obscured, and just kind of set it out there. God's going to remove that defective character when you're willing to let go of it, right? Everything I ever let go of had claw marks on it. Everything. But if I want rid of it, I have to let go of it. And some of these things that we hang on to, see, that's why in step six, it talks about in that little tiny paragraph, we pray for the willingness to have God remove it. I cannot remove my defects of character. You can't remove that. You can stop doing it, whatever it is. But that desire, that obsession, that wish, whatever it is, to keep doing that thing will eventually overwhelm you and you'll go back to it. So it's that obsession. It's that desire. It's the sponsoring thought. It's what's happening in the background that's driving you to keep doing that when you know that that's not the right thing to do. That's not what God would have you do, whatever that thing is. And so you're talking about it, but the action that you, your part, this is my, and I could be wrong, but my take on this is we pray for the willingness and we humbly ask him to remove these things. And when God gets ready, he'll remove it. And I like what he said. He's going to either remove all of it or he's not going to do it yet. He's not going to partially take part of it away. And however big that thing is, it's been my experience, these things that I don't want to let go of, these things that I obsess over, these things I do that I'm not supposed to be doing, and maybe it's embellishing a story, cash register honesty, it doesn't matter what it is, but these things, if I've done my homework in step five, if I got honest about that thing and I told my sponsor about it, I've already begun the process of elimination, right, of getting it out of me because it's something that's in me. We're only as sick as our secrets, and that might be the thing. I don't know. That might be the thing that comes back in 2, 3, 5 years to bite me in the rear end and send me back out. These secrets that we hold are actually reservations. That's just my take on it. So I do think that God's going to remove it. I have no doubt. There's no doubt in my mind that God will remove it. But for me, it comes down to how willing am I to let him do it? And have I humbly asked him to take this thing from me that I don't want anymore? Does that make sense? Does that answer your question? Okay, good. All
right. Next. See, she's good. I mean, you're not going to have this opportunity often.
Yeah, hey, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. Talks, both of you. I just was reflecting on the idea in the book. It says that we're always hard on ourselves and easy on others, right? And I think my experience was that I've taken that a little too literally and cultivated a black belt in self-flagellation in sobriety and always being a little too hard on myself. And what I found out through the inventory work is that what that did, that self-flagellation thing was a form of pride, actually. Can you relate to that?
So my job's to repeat the questions. Does anybody find themselves beating themselves up, right, and holding yourself to a really high standard, which may or may not be attainable, right? And is that a form of spiritual pride? Is that a fair assessment of the question? And yes. You know, and I mean, since I got here, right, I wanted to have 1 year sober to get a bronze chip, right? Like, 30 days, those dinky metal red. I mean, you're not kidding me, baby. I want a bronze, you know, I want that, right? I want to be a year sober at 30 days. And when I got a year, I mean, what's a year? I want to be with the guys with 5 years. I mean, if I had 5 years, people would know I was really doing something. And at 5 years, I mean, we all know that, you know, nobody really thinks you're sober at 5 years. It's when you get double digit sobriety, man. When I got a decade, I need an excellent, right? And I just always want to be where I'm not. Right? Spiritually and otherwise, like sober wise and all of that stuff. And I'm pretty good at holding myself to an unattainable standard. Then I can get frustrated. Then I can, have some excuses for coming up short. It's just, I always have to remind myself that the highest rank any of us achieve is sober dude or dudette, right? Just so like normal human, average human, right? On a good day, I get to be average human. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to do on my best days is to navigate through life's twists and turns virtually undetected as an alcoholic, right? It places me on even ground with every other human being. You know, and that's what I get to be. I mean, we already had, like I said, we had a perfect guy. You know what they did to him? I mean, it didn't look good. You know, come down from the cross, right? It's that kind of stuff. You guys have told me all kinds of stuff like that when I'm, but this is the part where I need God because I don't know where the balance is. I'll use that now. You say something like that to me and I'm like, well, I can cut back my meetings. I mean, the guy said I need to take it easy on myself, right? And then I'll go the other way, right? The pendulum, right? He said, let myself off the hook and like where all that is in the middle and finding that middle ground. I think that's what we're all after, and that's the life that we live of constant inventory. It's why we have step 10 and, you know, that evening inventory. How did I do today? Right? How did I do today? And, I think if you had my wife here, right, she would tell you on the sliding scale of jerk, I've gone from like a 10, maybe down to a 6, you know, I'm doing substantially better, but I'm a 6 on the jerk scale, right, on certain days. And that's good stuff, right? That's substantial progress. I want to be no jerk none of the time, but we're not there yet. So, welcome to the game of spiritual progress, just like the rest of us. Good, go up here and then back there. Yes, ma'am.
Everybody, my name is Dawn Hayes. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dawn.
I'm going to be here again this year, and thank you so much for this last night. I'm so excited to be here again, Terry. Not so much a question, but when I was having a lot of those thoughts and things, I remember a speaker, Polly P, saying from the podium, it's not so much that I'm thinking bad about myself, it's that I'm only thinking of myself. Mm-hmm. And so that really brought it to me where I could understand, you know, that it centers a sense of pride and selfishness and self-centeredness. And help me, you know, my sponsor told me, John, you're supposed to take the bath, put it down, put it in the back of the closet and shut the door. You know, quit beating yourself up. And an old timer around that time told me that I had to ask God to help me to forgive myself, you know, among all the other things that we've asked of God. And I saw him like a week later and said, oh, I've been praying that every morning and every night. And he looked at me and he goes, you know, Dawn, you only had to ask him once. And then I knew at that point that God had forgiven me and I could move on better.
Thank you. For the folks in Tape Land, that was a very nice share about her experience with this stuff. Question?
Just a follow-up to what you were saying, Rich. How do I tell the difference between if I have a defect or if it's a gift? One example is when I move to school in a group of people, I start joking and they start laughing. My wife sizes up to me and she says, Anthony, you're talking too much when you start to slow down. If I'm doing the right thing, if I'm abusing a gift, or is it a gift at all?
Okay, how do we distinguish a defect from an asset, essentially, right? Like what things, Bill describes these things as very natural instincts, right, that we all have. The problem is, shockingly, right, we as alcoholics tend to take them to extreme. He says, like, instincts run awry. It's a nice way of saying it, right? To say the least. Yeah, they went awry, all right. I think my answer to that, I know what I do each year around New Year's, and I have been doing this for like the last 5 years, is I sit with the people that matter the most to me independently. Usually around that, how we're all off. It's like that Christmas, New Year's-y kind of year. And I sit with my mom and I go, hey, Mom, can you help me out? What kind of son have I been for the last year? What am I doing that you like and don't like? And I open the door for her to take my inventory. I do it with my sister. My sister's answer last year to me after years, just so you could here, right? She goes, you know, you're like the most reliable guy in my life. Anything ever went wrong, you would be my first phone call. If I was broke down in Wyoming, you know. But if something emotional happened, like God forbid my husband left me, you would be my last phone call. Because you would start giving me action steps to work through the sadness and, you know, you know, you're just unapproachable in that way. You're always trying to, like, help me. You know, I'm not in AA. I don't want steps out of it. I want to wallow in it. I'm not interested in solving anything or moving forward, right? I want a big brother that I can just cry on. And you're not him, right? And guess what? We got some years to go, and it's good to know that, right? Because if you ask me, I go, yeah, it's given me this tremendous gift, right, that I have these steps to help people, you know, navigate anything that's going on in life. It's one of the beautiful gifts of AA. We have a solution to any problem. Doo-doo-doo, AA, right? And, you know, and here's, like, one of the core people in my life, my only little sister, who will call me for a flat tire, but not her husbandly, right? So it's like, hey, got some work to do. I sit down, you know, with my wife. What kind of husband have I been? And I hear what's working and what's not, right? Because I'm not good at grading my own paper. I don't think there's ever going to be a day where I can, like, look at myself and go, oh, that's a real asset. That's a defect, right? I have a sponsor. I have the people that love me. And the longer that I participate in this process, the more open I become to the input of other people. Because after those first couple inventories, does it really matter what I think of me? Right? Does it matter what I get in step four, or does it matter what she thinks is blocking our relationship? If I want to have a relationship with her, it's the other person, right? So, and now I've listened to my sponsor for a while, and I just get more and more comfortable with critique. I don't know that that's the right word, right? Whatever that is, suggestion, and I just want to be a part of your life. I want to be connected with you. And if I'm doing something that I think is cute and funny, I mean, one of my other big ones is sarcasm. You know, I think I'm funny. She's like, you're not funny. You know, that stuff hurts people sometimes. Quit it. I'm like, but that was a good joke. They laughed. And she's like, yeah, except for the one kid that left the room crying. You know, and I don't even know I'm doing it sometimes. So I'm with you. So I guess my solution is let other people evaluate that for me and help me. We're not in this. Let me say, this is important. Spiritual progress, in my experience, can never be achieved alone. Anything that I think I achieved may be an achievement. It may be a great thing in the material world, but spiritually it just set me back like 2 years. Right? I just got a master's degree spiritually over here. Right? Job got a big raise. They advanced me spiritually. Right? So I like spiritual stuff is done as a group. Was there a hand? Over? Yes, sir.
My name's Dana. I am an alcoholic. Other stuff. But, I look at 6 and 7 as
giving
my permission to myself to never work on my character defects ever again. Mm-hmm. Because the character defect is a failure to practice. You know, we got air and a glass of water up there. The easiest way to get the air out is to pour the clean water in. And I think that was they had this thing that showed the principles on one side and the defects on the other. And I tear the card in half and just hand them the principles. What's your thoughts on that?
Go for it.
Pouring water, baby.
So, could you redefine the question? We're going to piggyback off each other here.
What is your experience with the concept that it's really not our job anymore to work on defects or shortcomings, that they're not to be, quote unquote, worked on? Is that the concept? Instead, focused on the alternative spiritual principle instead of the thing lacking. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Okay. And okay, thank you for clarification. Part of my brain is saying, cop out. And then the other part of my brain is hearing that argument, and I get that at a different level. But if my problem, if I'm looking at pornography every single day, not that I do, but I'm just using that as an example, and I've asked God in my, you know, I've told my sponsor about it when I took my fifth step. I had wrote it in the fourth, told my sponsor about it. I'm engaged in step 6 and 7. I just got home from doing my fifth step, and we talked about my issue, my obsession with pornography. And then I prayed, and I've asked God to remove it, right? And I did step 6 and 7. So the next morning, I'm getting ready for work, and I hear the computer, ding, you know, the little sound it makes when an email comes, and my attention is drawn to go back in that room. So are you implying that I don't need to take any action, that God just took that away? And my response to that would be, I need to do the footwork of these steps. God is going to remove the obsession from pornography if I stay off the computer. I need to stay off the computer. Does that make sense? And so and people may have other opinions on that, but that's just my persuasion, is that I have to do the footwork. I can't let God physically take the wheel. I mean, yeah, God, steer my life, direct my life, but I'll end up in the bushes. Like, you can't physically take the wheel. Like, I need to physically stay off the computer. I need to stay away from those websites. And so I have a role in this. This is a team effort. I don't think that we just expect God to just lift that from us. It doesn't, in my world, it just doesn't work like that. I wish it did. That I could just, you know, if I focused my energy on the women that I sponsor and doing the AA gigs on the weekends and stuff like that, that the obsession for pornography would just leave me. I don't know. My life isn't like that. That my life, I have to actively work on these things. These are blocks between me and God. That pornography is a block. Because my attention should be on Him and how I can help God's kids. But I'm thinking about that woman on the screen, right? Or that man, whatever it is. Like, so no, I think we need to do the footwork. Does that make sense? Did anybody else, can I get a nod? Yeah? Okay. The women are applauding. Do the men agree? Did you notice that?
There's a spiritual principle that you never touch that subject after a woman talks about pornography. we have 3 minutes. Let's do one more.
Because you have to eat. You don't have to watch pornography. You know what I mean? You have to eat. Well, what is the difference between eating and we won't go there. But eating and gluttony. And so I was processing that. And when you talk about God, you know, when you're eating something that's feeding your body, you know that there's not a disconnection from God. But if you're like, go and get like, you know, 12 dozen donuts, and you sit in your room and you eat them up, you know, because you want to disconnect or pass out or check out or feed that, whatever that energy of disconnection, there is a difference. You're not connecting with God in your practice of these natural desires.
I think that question or statement or observation goes to the degree of a defect and the willingness that we've heard talked about of wanting something removed, right? And let's not forget that sentence that's in there, right? When do I become willing to have these removed? When it becomes objectionable to me, right? And when you invite me to go sit at the pool with you, and I have to say no thank you and make up a lie, because the truth is, and I've been there, I'm uncomfortable with my body image and I'm overweight and I just can't even sit by a swimming pool and share time with you. Remember, because what I'm after is connection. Right? My eating's now a problem. Hey, do you want to go play golf? Oh, I used to be able to swing the club, but now I can't get around my belly. Right? Maybe that makes it objectionable to me. Hey, I'd like to go surfing. It's my favorite thing, but I can't do it anymore. And I've been there where my weight, I wasn't the surfer that I used to be, right? When I first got sober, I was a big guy. And guess what? It became objectionable to me, not to you. And I don't, you know, this is not a critique on anyone's life or what. It's when each of those things becomes objectionable to us, whatever they are, right? Hey, my sex life is getting crappy because I'm on the computer, right? Probably became objectionable because it reached that point of objectionableness, right? To us. And I think that's what first motivates us, right? At least according to the book. It tells me that when these things become objectionable, I will eventually become willing. You know? And it doesn't mean it's objectionable to you. I'm sure you have some real feelings about how I should be eating, right? There's nothing more annoying, right, than people who are like, well, you know, you should be gluten-free and para-hippie, you know, patabolic and blah, 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 right? And I'm like, all right, thanks for sharing, you know. Please pass the steak, you know. There's nothing more annoying, right, than a reformed anything. We've learned that from our book, right? The person that just quit smoking, that's, you know, that's killing you. You didn't get sober to kill yourself with cigarettes, right? Like, thank you. Guess what? It's not objectionable to me yet. But we get there when we get there, and then we ask for some relief from God. You guys, thanks for making this workshop fun.